This is from a movie.
Nothing.
Nothing.
I would have sworn somebody was here. What you doing?
I just wanted to see what brand it was.
City That Never Sleeps, 1953.
What brand was it? Nervous Nelly, 90 proof.
I suppose you boys are laughing at me, but I saw that elevator out of move.
Man, we're not laughing at you. This is what we're paid for, to answer every call. Most of them don't amount to much, but you can never tell when it's for real. Who knows? Maybe I'll see you later on tonight myself.
That's right. And if you ever see anything that bothers you, anything that you wonder about, you get us over here.
I sure will. Sure will do that.
It's a story of cops, crooks, and an assassin who's also a magician. Two gangsters spend most of the movie arguing over whether a mechanical man in a window display is a mime or a robot. If it's a mime, they have to kill him.
What are you doing here?
It's a bad movie, but most movies are. Movies aren't real. There's none of the satisfying ambiguity of real life. Who the hell among us has a character arc? Has your life, even for a moment, ever had a plot? That said, movies can be useful interpretations of reality, brief little slivers of what things could be if life were something more than a series of things that just happen. So, for this sixth episode of the Chicago Corruption Walking Tour podcast, I'm going to tell you a true and accurate version of the birth of the city of Chicago, from grassy fields to towering skyscrapers, using four movies.
Harry, look, look! The mechanical thing is crying!
Then he is a real man.
Chapter 1, City That Never Sleeps. That's about as coherent as 1953's City That Never Sleeps gets. In the movie, the living spirit of the city of Chicago takes the form of a man for one night, a police officer played by the Texan actor Chill Wills, best known for voicing Mr. Ed precursor Francis the Talking Mule. Aside from one brilliantly daffy scene where the assassin magician puts a rabbit into a hat and pulls out a gun and shoots a guy, the movie is just terrible. It's fraught with social commentary that never quite lands, and worse, all the characters think the word hood, as in hoodlum, is pronounced hood, like rhymes with dude. It gets really annoying. It is absolutely amazing. And when the world reopens, you should head to Odd Obsession Video Store on Milwaukee Avenue and rent it. But the movie is a love letter to Chicago's built space. It's filmed in the alleys and office buildings of 1950s Chicago. Dramatic scenes happen on L tracks. Stock footage of stockyards set the tone. It is a pointless collection of weird, random, unconnected stuff that just happens, but it happens amid beautiful architecture. And isn't that just Chicago in a nutshell? Beautiful architecture is also where this episode begins. The elevator scene we heard at the beginning of this episode was shot in this episode's location, the lobby of the red brick Marquette building at the northwest corner of Dearborn's and Adams. It's just a half block north of the street corner from last episode, the one where you could see four different gerrymandered state house districts. To listen to this episode in the proper location, the entrance you need to go through, once COVID-19 clears, stay home, save lives, is on the Dearborn side of the building. Before you go in, stop outside the door and glance up. You'll see a series of four bronze reliefs depicting the explorations of Father Jacques Marquette and fur trapper Louis Joliet, the first non-Indigenous people to explore the land that would become Chicago. The Marquette building is from 1895, designed by the firm of Holabird and Roche. Successor firm Holabird and Root today has its offices on the fifth floor. The building is one of the first skyscrapers in the world. Skyscraper is an architectural thing, not just a term for a very tall building. Now, it used to be that the taller you wanted to have a building, the thicker you had to make its walls, picture like old castles. The skyscraper was a late 1800s architectural innovation, where an internal metal skeleton supports thin walls. First walls made of brick, like the Marquette building in front of you, then later of glass, like Mies van der Rohe's Federal Plaza just to the south, where we spent the last episode. Chicago's 10-story Montauk building, which opened in 1883 and was torn down in 1902, was the first building to be called a skyscraper, but it wasn't substantially different from other buildings. It used cast iron columns and wrought iron floor beams, sure, but it still had exterior load-bearing walls, just like every other building and those old castles I just mentioned. It wasn't until 1885 that Chicago's home insurance building taught the world that a thin skeleton of iron and steel could hold up 10 stories of stone and businessmen. Home insurance architect William LeBaron Jenny, his firm partner would later write, was inspired in part by childhood memories of the thin braces of wood he saw Filipino men mesh and weave into sturdy houses during a 3-month trip to Manila on his father's New Bedford whaling ship. The Marquette building was part of the building boom that followed home insurance. The building's skeleton was modeled after home insurance. Its location was spurred by the train station in Printer's Row. You can see the clock tower of the train station from where you're standing if you look due south and have excellent vision. During non-COVID times, from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., 7 days a week, the Marquette lobby and a small architectural exhibit in the next room are free and open to the general public. Go in. Go through one of the revolving doors engraved with the bronze kick plates of the altogether mysterious Calumet peace pipe that the chief of the Illinois presented early missionary Jacques Marquette as a token of friendship. It's a very romantic gesture. Less romantic is the fact that the Calumet was presented alongside a second gift, quote, a little slave. Marquette wrote that the Calumet was a gift, quote, upon which they placed more value than upon a slave. Once you get inside, look around. You are in one of the most beautiful lobbies downtown Chicago offers. To each side of you, marble staircases swoop up to the second of 2 stories of bronze and colored glass. The Tiffany glass mosaics encircling the walls depict the early days of what would become Chicago and the French trappers, traders, and missionaries who were the first non-Indigenous people to pass through the area. All but 2 of the 22 bronze portraits over the 2 levels of elevators were done by Edward Kemmes, the sculptor of the lions outside of the Art Institute of Chicago. Amy Aldous Bradley sculpted the other 2, the most important ones, Marquette and Joliet themselves, who led the 1673 expedition depicted throughout the rest of the lobby. Seeing white and Indigenous people scattered together, each given a name and an identity, in a piece of art from the 1800s can be momentarily touching. We're used to nameless, interchangeable Native Americans in our public art. We're used to James Earl Fraser's sculpture on the southwestern Michigan Avenue Bridge House of Native Americans attempting to murder innocent women and children. And that thing's from 1928. So it is sort of amazing to see Native Americans given names and identities in a piece of art from the 1890s. Sort of. The depictions are problematic. Tiffany's head mosaicist on the project, J.A. Holzer, he did beautiful work portraying the meetings between the French explorers and the Illinois Confederacy. But he put the men of the Illinois in the clothing, headdresses, and accessories of Great Plains tribes. The Tiffany glass and bronze portraits are still, at the end of the day, 1800s frontier art, informed and guided by racial stereotype and the principle of manifest destiny. There's a great article on the lobby on JSTOR by art historian Ellen Caldwell, if you're interested. So our first movie, City That Never Sleeps, a love letter to built space, took us to this lobby, a good starting point for our story. This brings us to the second movie that tells the history of Chicago. This film has the most historically accurate retelling I've ever seen of the forces that spurred the birth of the city of Chicago. Chapter 2, Blazing Saddles. While we might remember Mel Brooks's 1974 Western spoof comedy for...
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Or...
not Heady, it's Headley.
Or my personal favorite,
Mongo only pawn in game of life.
Its plot, like Chicago's, wasn't about heroism and dramatic Oscar bait sacrifice like movies about the Old West. It was about land values and transportation infrastructure, like the actual Old West. In the movie, there's a sleepy little community, Rock Ridge, and land values there were about to skyrocket because of a change in the transportation infrastructure, a new train line. In the 1800s, in real life, land values in the sleepy little community around Fort Dearborn were about to skyrocket because of a change in the transportation infrastructure, the creation of the Illinois-Michigan Canal. Going a bit geological on ya, the Great Lakes and Mississippi River systems don't naturally touch, at least not in a way traversable by boat. Look at the mosaic on the south side of the lobby. You'll see the Marquette-Joliet expedition in the middle of receiving a priestly blessing. But more importantly, you'll see their canoes. After heading down the Mississippi, the expedition turned around in modern-day Arkansas when they saw the local tribes trading Spanish goods. They realized they could get captured by the Spaniards if they kept going to the Gulf of Mexico. So on the way back to the Canada, Marquette and Joliet took a shortcut. They headed up the Illinois River before they had to hop out of their canoes and carry them along the marshy 6-mile slog through the portage at Mud Lake. From there, they would hit the Chicago River, then Lake Michigan, then the Great Lakes, then home. Although heavy rains would occasionally flood the swamp enough that canoes could row through Mud Lake, a soggy haul on foot through the Chicago portage would become the boat route between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River system for the next 150 years. Now turn around to look at the mosaic on the north side of the lobby. On a field of yellow, you'll see the glass tile face of Louis Joliet. As far back as 1673, Joliet suggested digging a prairie canal, bypassing the portage and connecting the Illinois and Chicago rivers. Great idea. But it wasn't the French or the British who'd build it. It was a nation that didn't even exist when Joliet had his brainstorm. In 1822, the United States Congress made a land grant to Illinois to build the canal. Chicago was going to be the one place on the planet people would have to pass through when going between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. The land was about to become some of the most valuable real estate on Earth. But, to quote Headley Lamar,
"Unfortunately, there is one thing that stands between me and that property, the rightful owners."
And that meant ousting the Potawatomi. Now, the state of Illinois had title to the land from the U.S. government. The land was already stolen, no problems there. But the 4-year-old state didn't have money to dig a canal. Illinois needed loans, which meant they needed settlers to prove to investors that the region was a good investment. The Potawatomi needed to be ousted because they scared off settlers. They scared off investors. Chicago was best known for the 1812 Fort Dearborn Massacre, and for being a silty river delta, so slick with mud, an early visitor said, quote, "I would not pay 6 pence an acre for the whole of it." So even with the canal pending, Chicago real estate was not an easy sell. A series of acts from 1822 to 1834 loosened the land sales laws. They piecemeal dropped the minimum acreage a person could buy. They increased the time allowed between purchase of a land and when you had to occupy it, and it kept lowering the standards until they hit the sweet spot where greed would overcome self-preservation and settlers would flock to the land. They hit that sweet spot, by the way, in 1833. I'd love to say it was economics that jolted development, but really it was the expulsion of the Potawatomi, based on a lie a cowardly officer told the world to cover a humiliating defeat. On May 4th, 1832, a small band of Sauk warriors led by Black Hawk moved east from Indiana to Illinois to reclaim land ceded in the Treaty of 1804. They considered the treaty invalid. They wanted their land back. This small band came across a powerful U.S. detachment of 275 men under the command of Major Isaiah Stillman. How'd it go? Today it's known as the Battle of Stillman's Run, because Stillman ran. To save face after the humiliating defeat, one of Stillman's officers fabricated a report. He said it hadn't been a small sock party they'd scampered away from, but instead they had been, quote, invaded by a powerful detachment of Indian warriors of the Sauk, Fox, Winnebago, and Potawatomi, and part of the Kickapoo Nation. Although some Potawatomi did actually join Black Hawk, the tribe as a whole had rejected the delegates who tried to get them to join the campaign. The Potawatomi had actually sent their own delegation of chiefs to Chicago a few days before Stillman's Run to assure American officials they had no intention of joining Black Hawk's uprising. That's not to say all was rosy with the Potawatomi before the officer made up the report. We'll actually get into that in episode 15, which will look at Chicago's first murder. But the officer's lies gave the United States government a convenient excuse. They used the lies about Stillman's Run to oust the tribe and make the region more attractive to developers. After the Black Hawk War was quashed in August of 1832, Congress appointed a commission of three to deal with the Potawatomi and, quote, extinguish Indian title within the states of Indiana and Illinois and the territory of Michigan. The trio negotiated a deal at Camp Tippecanoe, Indiana, in October 1832, taking all the Potawatomi land in Illinois, plus Indiana and Michigan. Part of the deal included merchandise valued at $45,000, paid to the tribe immediately, right there. And another part was another promise $30,000 worth of goods to be negotiated by treaty the next year at, you guessed it, Chicago. The Potawatomi were pushed and prodded west over the next year in a forced migration that, like all the other forced migrations of indigenous people, was plagued by disease and incompetence. Resentment grew among the Potawatomi, who didn't recognize the deal their leaders cut. Resentment grew among the white settlers, who simply wanted the tribe gone. The procession arrived at the future City That Works in the autumn of 1833, months behind schedule and hungry for that promised $30,000 in goods. Chicagoans got the city ready for the Potawatomi. They marked up goods as high as 50%. Prostitution was rampant. Settlers and French traders flocked to the encampments to get the Potawatomi drunk and take them for all the money they had left from the Camp Tippecanoe payout, along with every single possession they owned. Treaty observer Henry Vander Bogart wrote this in 1833. They had brought some whiskey and given them, which soon made them drunk. Then some directed their attention, while others stole all their goods, even taking their last blanket. Many who had three or four blankets the day before yesterday were naked. They will give anything they have for whiskey, and as soon as they are drunk, they are stripped to the skins by the whites. Such infernal villainy would make the devil blush. The sale of alcohol to the Potawatomi was illegal, but the tribe was there to negotiate a treaty. The U.S. government found that drunken negotiation partners were pliant ones. British traveler Charles J. Latrobe wrote this in 1835. However anxious I and others might be to exculpate the United States government from the charge of cold and selfish policy towards the remnant of the Indian tribes, and from that of resorting to unworthy and diabolical means of obtaining possession of their land, as long as it can be said with truth that drunkenness was not guarded against, and that the means were furnished at the very time of the treaty and under the very noses of the commissioners, how can it be expected but a stigma will attend every transaction of this kind? The sin may lie at the door of the individuals more immediately in contact with them, but for the character of the people as a nation, it should be guarded against, beyond a possibility of transgression. Who will believe that any act, however formally executed by the chiefs, is valid as long as it is known that whiskey was one of the parties to the treaty? On September 26, 1833, Three U.S. officials signed and 77 Potawatomi leaders put X marks on the Treaty of Chicago. The refugees from Indiana and other out-of-town points dispersed as soon as they got their payments. Eventually, the only Potawatomi left in the area were the ones originally from the area. The treaty gave them 2 years to get the hell out of town. Their lives in the settlement were spent as prey of bunco, greed, and alcohol. But on an unnamed day in August 1835, the final 800 Potawatomi left Chicago as warriors. Years later, early settler and later Illinois Supreme Court Chief Justice John Dean Caton wrote this about the Potawatomi's last day. They assembled at the council house, near where the lake house now stands, on the north side of the river. All were entirely naked, except a strip of cloth around the loins. Their bodies were covered all over with a great variety of brilliant paints. On their faces particularly, they seemed to have exhausted their art of hideous decoration. Foreheads, cheeks, and noses were covered with curved stripes of red or vermilion, which were edged with black points, and gave the appearance of a horrid grin over the entire countenance. The long, coarse black hair was gathered into scalp locks on the top of their heads, and decorated with a profusion of hawks and eagles' feathers, some strung together so as to extend down the back nearly to the ground. They were principally armed with tomahawks and war clubs. They were led by what answered for a band of music, which created what may be termed a discordant din of hideous noises produced by beating on hollow vessels and striking sticks and clubs together. They advanced not with a regular march, but with a continued dance. Chicago's last war dance started by the Wrigley Building, then headed west along the riverbank past Trump Tower, Marina City, and the 3D printer experience. The 800 warriors danced through the merchandise mart, across the old walking bridge that predated the abandoned train track, now permanently slung at attention. They danced south past glass towers of law firms and global investment banks. They stopped for special performances across the river from Starbucks, and east along Lake Street at the Franklin Self Park, Ronnie's original steakhouse, at the Thompson Center, and at the 7-Eleven at Dearborn. This is where they danced. Back to Caton. Their muscles stood out in great hard knots, as if wrought to a tension which must burst them. Their tomahawks and clubs were thrown and brandished about in every direction, and with the most terrible ferocity, and with a force and energy which could only result from the highest excitement. And with every step and every gesture, they uttered the most frightful yells in every imaginable key and note, though generally the highest and shrillest possible. The dance, which ever continued, consisted of leaps and spasmodic steps, now forward and now back or sideways, with the whole body distorted into every imaginable unnatural position, most generally stooping forward, with the head and face thrown up, the back arched down, first one foot thrown far forward and then withdrawn, then the other similarly thrust out, frequently squatting quite to the ground, and all with a movement almost as quick as lightning. With a final dance for the garrison at Fort Dearborn, by the modern intersection where you can get a hop-on, hop-off tour bus, a great snapshot of Trib Tower, or an official NHL-licensed Blackhawks jersey, the Potawatomi left Chicago. They departed as gods. Now the only people left for the settlers to scam were each other. And this brings us to movie 3 of the 4 movies that tell the story of Chicago. It's a dark tale of con artists, grifters, and soulless cutthroats.
Please observe me if you will. I'm Professor Harold Hill, and I'm here to organize a River City Boys band.
Chapter 3, my friends, how can any The Music table ever hope to compete with a gold trombone? From 1962, but based on the 1957 Broadway musical, The Music Man is about a con artist who swept into a small Midwestern river community to feed the people lies and run off with their cash. The con men flocked to Chicago, too, after the Potawatomi's last dance. But since the Chicago Public Library District wouldn't be established for 40 more years, there were no sexy local librarians to lure the Harold Hills of the real world into the path of righteousness. We had trouble. Right here in River City. with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for property values. Once the 1833 treaty that would eventually kick out the Potawatomi was signed, property values in Chicago spiked. Land had already risen from $1.25 an acre in 1830 to $60 an acre by 1833, but the knowledge that the Potawatomi would soon be gone kicked speculation into gear. One lot in what's now Wackern Wells sold for $66 in October 1833. In November 1833, it sold again for $800. $66 to $800 in a month. In today's money, that's buying land for $1,600 and selling it next month for $20,000. A corner of what's now Wackern Clark sold for $100 in 1833. In 1834, it sold for $3,500. And in 1835, it sold for $15,000. In today's money again, that's $2,500 to $85,000 to $354,000 in 2 years. 1835 was a big year for the land boom that built Chicago. In February, the state legislature authorized the governor to pledge the canal lands for a $500,000 loan to start construction. In May, a government land office opened in Chicago. In August, the Potawatomi left. And in December, the newly created State Bank of Illinois opened an office in Chicago, spewing out loans to whomever had a hot sale they wanted to pursue. Harold Hillish speculators flocked from across the planet to make a quick buck in Chicago real estate. In 1833, Chicago's population was 350 people. In 1837, just 4 years later, it was 4,170. And it was all based on credit. It was called wildcat banking, and it was not just a Chicago thing. This was how the West was funded. Unregulated state banks sprang out paper money with nothing in reserve to cover their loans in case the market soured. How could it? How could any loan go south? We had this entire continent to explore and exploit. Chicago, and most of the American West, was a credit-backed housing bubble. Sound familiar? An early Chicago settler named J.N. Ballastier said the following during a lecture to the Chicago Lyceum in 1840, 3 years after the boom town became a boom city. Quote, credit, reckless and indiscriminate, was the master principle of those wild and maddening days, overleaping every barrier, disdaining restraint, tempting the inexperienced and unwary, laughing to scorn the calculating and prudent, alluring the ignorant and avaricious. The evil spirit went forth, sowing at broadcast the prolific seeds of bankruptcy and ruin. By the time Ballastier delivered the lecture in 1840, quote, all that remained to support life in Chicago was hope. The poverty of the place was visible and unfeigned. The more land a man had, the worst off he apparently was. The laughing credit and unfeigned poverty were just 3 years apart from each other. Now, it wasn't that settlers just showed up in Chicago and lost their fool minds. An entire speculator class developed to whip the settlers into a splurging frenzy with their life savings. The speculators went big, broad, and theatrical. Here's how one speculator of the 1830s would work the crowd before the auction even started, as recorded in Moses Kirkland's 1895 History of Chicago, Aboriginal to Metropolitan. And I apologize, this does feature some dated racial language. A Negro, dressed up in gaudy colors, with a scarlet flag, and riding a white horse with harness of scarlet, rode through the town, announcing the hour at which the sale would begin. Crowds flocked around and hung upon his entrancing words. At the appointed time, the expectant multitude drew nigh, and with a skillful auctioneer to play upon the excited passions of eager purchasers, there were no bounds to which enthusiastic, nay, mad bidders would not go. It wasn't just Chicago these speculators were selling. This was a key point in the development of the Midwest. They called them paper cities. places that existed nowhere except for a greedy developer's plat map and a gullible settler's future. The auctioneer would spin tales of pristine forests, little streams trickling into mighty lakes, soil so fertile you could throw seeds on the ground and get a crop. Once the word storm cleared and the wagons pitched west, the settlers would find themselves the owners of some of the most inhospitable landscape the Midwest offered. Here's how a different settler would work his crowds into that gullible frenzy. A settler child named Edwin O. Gale would recall him in a book he wrote in 1902 as an old man. Every old settler knew little Jimmy Marshall, though few were aware that he was a physician by profession and a dancing master by calling in 1834. Always carefully groomed, he was to be seen in a silk hat, black frock coat, dark trousers, well-polished boots, and immaculate shirt bosom. He was at all times ready to trip the light fantastic, and he tripped it, too. How that nimble little figure would wind through the mazes of the Money Musk or the rollicking Virginia Reel. Those were dances that made his black eyes shine with a brighter luster than the diamond he so much admired. When selling goods, Marshall's limber tongue moved as fast as his nimble feet in a double shuffle. I yet seem to hear his 2½ and a half and a half and a half, make it 3, 3, do I hear any more than 3, 3, 3½ and a half and a half, I'm bid, make it 4, and so on until knocked down.
And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit and listening to some big out-of-town Jasper hearing him tell about horse race gambling.
We shall never forget him as long as the red flag flies. So lured by the economic opportunities of the Promise Canal, speculators, fortune hunters, con men, and the rest of what Hollywood Westerns call pioneers flocked to Chicago. The credit-backed housing bubble was bubbling. In a village called Hardscrabble, renamed Bridgeport for the occasion, amid celebratory cannons, speeches, and music, Irish transient laborers turned the first spades of canal dirt on July 4, 1836. That same day, 595 miles away in Washington, D.C., Congress approved an act to reorganize the General Land Office, placing the office directly under the control of the president. 7 days later, President Andrew Jackson burned the whole thing down. Jackson wanted to put an end to this wildcat banking and paper money backed by frenzy. On July 11, 1836, he issued an executive order called the Specie Circular. It demanded all purchases of government land be made entirely with gold or silver. Paper money plummeted in value, and metal-strapped banks eventually stopped redeeming their notes in the required gold and silver. The Specie Circular, coupled with a swamp of economic factors, including such diverse elements as the effect of British banking policy on the price of cotton, economies are difficult, triggered a nationwide financial collapse and a 6-year depression. The Panic of 1837 started out east, spreading to Illinois banks the same year the village of Chicago became a city. A separate banking crisis in 1839 kicked the nation while it was down. In November 1839, Mayor William Butler Ogden estimated that Chicago's best business properties had fallen 75% in value since 1836. Outlying lands plummeted 90 to 95% in value. Some got out in time. Gurdon Hubbard, Hubbard Street is named after him, made an aggregate $80,000 off an initial investment of $66. In today's money, he put in $1,600 and got more than $1.7 million. Most people lost everything. As J.W. Norris wrote in the General Directory and Business Advertiser of the City of Chicago for the year 1844, the day of wrath and retribution was at hand. Confidence and credit, too long abused, refused any longer to lend their aid. The unfortunate victims of the delusion were suddenly awakened from their dream of wealth to the certainty of almost universal bankruptcy and ruin. Thousands from affluence were reduced without warning or preparation to poverty. Some struggled for a time with their destiny, but the evil day came at last, and scarcely one ultimately survived the catastrophe. To glimpse the whirlwind, let's look at Dearborn and Randolph, where the Daily Center is. A lot on that corner sold for $60 in 1832. In 1836, the southwest corner, a tip of the plaza where today the massive steel Picasso guards a 30-story courthouse, sold for $7,800. In 1839, after the double-punch banking crises and nationwide housing collapse, Ogden valued the southwest corner lot at $350 at fair valuation, or $200 in the more likely for sale. So it had gone from $60 to $7,800 to $200 in 7 years. Ogden seemed to feel bad about that lot. He wrote in a letter that it seemed, at least to use his word, questionable to set the land's value at a time when, quote, no one has any money to buy property at any price. But at least the canal was still coming with all the trade and industry those boats would bring. Right? That brings us to our fourth and final movie that shows the true history of the city of Chicago.
Hello, Peter. What's happening? I'm gonna need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. So if you could be here around 9, that would be great. Okay?
Chapter 4. Office Space. Office Space, from 1999, is Beavis and Butthead creator Mike Judge's brilliant workplace comedy about the 1990s dot-com bubble. It was written not knowing that that bubble was about to burst as well. It's a story about bad leadership, unintended consequences, staplers, and the importance of mundane details. The main character had a job he hated, combing through thousands of lines of banking software to add the 19 to dates in the 20th century, trying to prevent the then-future Y2K bug. People would put 92 instead of 1992 in software to save space, and no one thought of what would happen once the century turned. It was a mundane detail that almost collapsed the world's banking system. He and his friends hatched a plan to embezzle fractions of pennies from the company, earning a fortune over several years. But one of them, Michael Bolton, misplaced a decimal point. After a few days, they had hundreds of thousands of stolen dollars they couldn't get rid of without going to prison.
I always do that. I always mess up some mundane detail.
Oh! Well, this is not a mundane detail, Michael!
That brings us our own mundane detail that Chicago planners missed during the decades-long process of acquiring land, ousting tribes, and defrauding investors. They forgot about the Mohs scale of mineral hardness. The original plan for the Illinois-Michigan Canal was for a deep-cut canal fed by Lake Michigan and stepping down through a series of locks for 96 miles, from the Chicago River at what's now 27th and Ashland, out to the Illinois River by the small town of Peru. But 7 miles into the project, workers hit Illinois' dolomite limestone bedrock. They didn't know about that. The faces swirling around you in the lobby of the Marquette building were sculpted from bronze, which comes in at 3 on the Mohs scale of mineral hardness. Imagine trying to dig through miles of solid bronze with a hand shovel. Dolomite comes in at 3.5 to 4 on the Mohs scale. It'd be like digging through bronze plus a third again. No matter how many Irishmen and Germans they threw at the canal project, the canal that they built a city around had always been a physical impossibility. The Canal Commission frantically redid its plans. This time they were going to create an elevated canal. It would be expensive, but doable. Except for the fact that, you know, the entire U.S. economy was crumbling around them. First, Illinois held bond sales at increasing discounts to keep construction going. Then they started paying contractors in scrip, which is basically alternate currency IOUs to be redeemed when there was money to be had. That script pops up again in episode 9 of this podcast, incidentally. Long story short, script is sort of a big blank check slash gift card that's as good as cash. Boxes of untraceable money don't fare well in Illinois government. But that's episode 9. I'm getting ahead of myself. The script didn't work either. The state of Illinois defaulted on its interest payments on July 1, 1841. The value of its bonds fell on the open market to 15 cents on the dollar. Work on the canal petered out by year's end. The project, meant to build a state, bankrupted it. Work resumed in 1845 with a new, cheaper, shallow cut plan. It would be fed by local streams instead of the lake. It would still take years, but it would be about half the price, and at least there'd be a canal. On April 10, 1848, the Governor Fry was the first canal boat into the city of Chicago. On October 10th of that year, 6 months to the day later, the Pioneer was the first train into Chicago. Long story short, trains won. Trains were faster, cheaper, could spread around the nation regardless of river systems, and it sort of helps when your entire transportation infrastructure doesn't freeze over every winter. Chicago grew not as a canal center, but as a rail hub. In a special insult, the Chicago and Rock Island Railroad Company obtained right-of-way alongside the canal in 1851. They opened in 1854, speeding right past those languid boats, sort of serving as advertising for people wondering, why didn't they just take the train? Meanwhile, Chicagoans were pooping in the river. The industrial waste, manufacturing waste, human waste, garbage, and other detritus of the Industrial Revolution was just dumped into the Chicago River, which at the time flowed out into Lake Michigan, which was and remains the source of Chicago's drinking water. The river was brackish and diseased, with the lake soon following. I've got to take a moment to debunk something here. Although there was a rise in typhoid fever deaths, tales of cholera outbreaks that killed thousands upon thousands of Chicagoans are, were, and remain urban legends. They just didn't happen. That's not to minimize the pollution, however. The Chicago River caught fire in 1899. Twice. The river's pollution initially helped the Illinois and Michigan Canal. It justified a deepening during the Civil War to shunt more waste away. But eventually, a larger solution was needed. In 1889, the Illinois General Assembly created the Sanitary District of Chicago to figure out the problem. They decided to reverse the flow of the Chicago River, keeping all the waste away from the drinking water. To do this, they built the massive Sanitary and Ship Canal connecting the Chicago River to the much lower Des Plaines River, sort of pulling a plug on the Chicago River and creating a much deeper and wider shipping canal to boot. The 28-mile Sanitary and Ship Canal, still in use today. The rivers that Joliet and Marquette once took north from the Mississippi were about to bear thousands of gallons of shit and disease heading in the other direction. St. Louis in particular was not thrilled about the reversal of the Chicago River. They secretly planned an injunction stopping work. Word of St. Louis's plans trickled up to Chicago. So on the early morning of January 2, 1900, a group of canal commissioners, accompanied by their wives, some friends, and two newspaper reporters who'd been tipped off, headed down to 35th and Kedzie with workers and hand shovels to bust open the dam before the law could stop them. After resorting to dynamite and then spending 2 hours using a dredge to hack through the ice, they busted through, pulling a plug on Lake Michigan and sending our shit southward. As the Chicago Tribune wrote, quote, "The flooding waters sent heavy spray over the feet of the men on the pier and threatened to carry the group, the pier, and the rest into the canal beneath. Like schoolboys on a vacation, the drainage officials waved their arms and shouted." So this did reverse the river, but the water was now backed up at the Bear Trap Dam at Lockport. Similar AM shenanigans on January 17, 1900, busted through that dam, sending the sewage Mississippi-ward down the Des Plaines. Chicago beat St. Louis's injunction by a few hours. The after effects of these early dawn maneuvers can be felt in everything in Chicago today, from Michiganders pissed off that we are still draining the lake, to the migration patterns of invasive zebra mussels. But for our story today about the birth of Chicago, there are two main effects to look at. First, reversing the river drained Joliet's nemesis, Mud Lake, the swamp that in 1673 they came up with the idea of building a canal just so they didn't have to go through it. Aside from a small wetlands in the village of Forest View, Mud Lake is gone. Its former boundaries are invisible among the declining industrial parks of Stickney and Cicero. Second, reversing the river made the Illinois and Michigan Canal completely obsolete. The I&M today is fishing and canoeing out west, but the canal that built the city doesn't exist at all in Chicago anymore. In the 1950s, the federal government filled in the last muddy bits and built Interstate 55. Sticker-clad SUVs and long-haul semis replaced canoes. So that's the story of Chicago in four movies. The sheer urban inanity of City That Never Sleeps. The greed of Blazing Saddles. The flim-flam of The Music Man. And the obliviousness and mismanagement of office space gave us this city that we love. We celebrate the heroes and legends, the Joliettes and Marquettes, the ones we want as our forebears. We save their faces in bronze and glass and put their names on skyscrapers and streets. The dancing auctioneer Jimmy Marshall, the lying soldiers of Stillman's Run, the canal commissioners leaping like schoolboys as they sent our shit southward. They are as much our ancestor as any priestly voyageur in glass. I'd like to take this opportunity for a personal announcement. 6 episodes into this 20-episode podcast, I'm putting the Chicago Corruption Walking Tour on hiatus. The reason is simple and stupid. The library's closed. Until the COVID-19 crisis clears, and local resources like the Harold Washington Library Center and the archives of the Chicago History Museum and the Newberry Library reopen, I can't access the sources I need to continue this podcast in the way I want to do it. Online research is great, and there are a lot of original source materials being digitalized every day. But the deep dive nerd resources this podcast demands, the really fringe source documents, and particularly the old newspaper archives, just aren't all available from my laptop. I don't want the most popular resources to be my only resources. If I'm doing this thing, I'm doing it right, and I'm doing it my way. And that means waiting for the libraries to reopen. If you can't wait for coronavirus to end without getting another heaping helping of me, at 6:30 p.m. this Thursday, I will be giving a Facebook Live lecture on 3 recent political scandals as part of a fundraiser for Chicago for Chicagoans. I'll cover red light cameras, blue bag recycling, and every Chicagoan's favorite gripe, the parking meter deal. More information at chicagoforchicagoans.org/events. In the meantime, stay safe, stay home, post like a million 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts telling everyone how great this thing is. And if you feel a need to say hi, I can be reached at 1001chicago@gmail.com. That's 1001chicago@gmail.com. I'll see you for episode 7, When the World Reopens.
Where are you headed, cowboy?
Nowhere special.
Nowhere special. I always wanted to go there.
Come on.